Well, slow food began as a protest against fast food. It started in Italy back in 1986 when a food writer named Carlo Petrini fought the opening of a McDonald's restaurant. And this all happened at the famous Spanish Steps there in Rome. Well, he lost that battle, but the slow food movement that he founded now has followers in more than 150 countries, and they include Australia. Let's meet two Aussies who've just been experiencing slow food at the Terra Madre and the Salone del Gusto, the Hall of Taste. These take place around the city of Turin every couple of years, and they attract tens of thousands of visitors. Maureen Chapman is Secretary of Slow Food Australia. Hi, Maureen.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. And Matthew Evans is with us as well. Matthew used to write on food for the Sydney Morning Herald, and he's published several foodie books. These days he farms pigs in the Huon Valley in Tassie. Hi, Matthew.
Yeah, g'day, Michael.
Now, would you say that you're a typical producer of slow food, Matthew?
Look, I guess I am. What I do is just follow my philosophy, which is to get as close to the source of the produce you eat as possible, and that ended up with me buying a place and growing my own food, you know, from fruit and vegetables to pigs and beef and lamb. But you don't need to actually do all that I've done. You can fulfill the slow food philosophy living in a town if you just know where your produce comes from. Get as close to it as possible. Trust where it comes from.
So how many pigs have you got?
At the moment I've got about 17 on the ground. Including three older ones that are the breeding stock and a whole bunch of little ones that cause mischief by escaping every opportunity.
So
they haven't got into the veggie garden yet.
They're not that slow.
No, well, I lost one up the road the other day. I had to chase it, and there was all these people with cameras taking photos of me rather than helping me.
You're shouting, you're supposed to be a slow pig.
Yeah, it was running faster than I could.
Yeah. Now, what about you, Maureen? How did you get into this?
Look, I think really through my my love of and connection with good food over many years. I've worked as a chef and a caterer for some years, and very well aware that what people really want now is exactly as Matthew said. They want to know where their food has come from, and they want to understand how it's been produced.
Now, when you say people want, I'm always a bit sceptical about people. I mean, who are these people who want this? It's not everyone, obviously, because most people go to the supermarket and just get their stuff and put it in the basket.
Well, yes, but, you know, that's true. Right now, that is what most people do, I guess. The people that I'd refer to are the people who've taken the time to ask a few more questions and who are becoming more and more aware. And I think the numbers of those people is growing exponentially.
The word people starting to become a bit freaky, isn't it?
It is a little bit.
We just keep saying it. Now, okay, so it sounds as though you've been having a ball in Turin. Maureen, what were you doing there?
I had a fabulous time. You know, apart from meeting and having a chance to talk with so many people from all over the world and from Australia, of course, including Matthew, it was a great opportunity to meet our own proponents in this country. But certainly the Terra Madre side of the event, being that opportunity to be involved in some really useful exchanges, you know, really interesting discussions about the sort of common challenges that we are facing around the world in terms of food production systems generally.
Well, Maureen, start at the beginning. So Terra Madre means Mother Earth. Mm-hmm. So what happens? What is it?
At Terra Madre we had, there were probably at least 6,000 people from over 130 countries who were mainly producers, people who are involved in producing their own food locally, protecting local varieties, and really, I guess, focusing on that connection between food and culture and community.
So it's a series of lectures and workshops and so on, is
it? Yes, that's right. And various different countries and different groups presented different issues that were the most important to them. But I guess what comes from that is an international audience all at each point nodding their heads and understanding that, yes, it's actually not just your issue. You know, a lot of these issues are common. One of the most important for me was probably listening to a lot of the issues being faced by the African communities in terms of the land grabbing.
Oh, yes. Do you want to talk some more about that?
Maybe just a little. I think you know, one of the most important points about the slow, or from the slow food movement, is that connection, as Matthew said, the connection between people and the land and the community and the food they eat. In places like Africa, you know, there is starvation, whole communities starving, massive issues with populations not having access to good, clean, healthy food. And in many cases, because they don't have access to their land. Their land has been bought by large private companies from other countries who are using that land to meet their own needs rather than meeting the needs of those local communities.
Mm. Now, Matthew, I know that you went to Terra Madre, but you also went to Salone del Gusto. What a wonderful phrase that is, del Gusto, the Hall of Taste. In fact, gusto sounds, there's more relish in the word gusto than there is in our word taste. It sounds a bit sort of light on the word taste.
You almost salivate saying the word gusto. Yeah, look, I should have been at Terra Madre with all the very worthy workshops and discussions, but right next door was the Hall of Taste with thousands of these small producers from around the world showcasing what they do using, you know, old-fashioned techniques, often modern technology, but in conjunction with tradition, to produce the most amazing food that anyone can imagine. It's supposed to be the biggest food event in the world, I think, Salone del Gusto, and you know, I only saw a fraction of it.
When you say saw, I mean, isn't there some eating going on here?
Oh, well, yeah, well, I only tasted a fraction of it. You can blame the 1,500 wines by the glass for part of my the fact I didn't make it all the way around, but I was focusing primarily on pork products. But, you know, I ate, on the first day I was there, probably about, 150 different pork products from different producers, all done, you know, mostly using free-range, old-breed pigs, all specialising in traditional ways of curing, methods that they've worked on for centuries and they know are safe, and producing incredible products. I mean, the wonderful thing about slow food is, yes, it's about culture and it's about tradition and it's about preserving the integrity of the land and the people who produce the food, but the other side of it is it all tastes wonderful. Mm. And that's what I submerged myself in for the years, particularly the first day I was there. It was just amazing.
So you're drawing some kind of lesson or moral from this, are you? There you are, a pork producer yourself. You're seeing this great diversity. And, of course, it's not coming off some kind of production line. It's a much more, well, it's a much smaller scale form of production, I guess.
Yeah, that was what was, it was totally inspirational for me to see these people who, you know, there was a mob there and they preserved salami. It's a very soft salami and it's low salt and it's preserved in a stomach. You'd think it would go off after a year because it's a year old, but they put their local chilies in there,
it's preserved in a stomach. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Look, it's really bizarre. It's a spreadable salami. It's soft, almost pate-like in texture. And it's not so hot that it burns your mouth out, but it's got this sort of warmth from the chilies. But the chilies and the salt combined preserve it. And it's a traditional, you know, it's a traditional thing from that part of southern Italy. It's,
you know, you haven't won me over on that one.
Oh, look, most of this stuff, you know, it would frighten most Australians. I tend to grow pigs with a lot of fat, and I watched people in Italy relishing the fat, whereas here I'm always trying to say to people, look, you only eat very small quantities of this. It's very rich, but you'll find the flavour very intense and hopefully pleasurable. In Italy, they were eating pigs with twice as much fat as the stuff I have, and you'll see very skinny, you know, 22-year-old women tipping their heads back, eating lardo, which is pure fat. It's just preserved salted fat, and giggling and laughing and going back for another bite.
Yes. You know, you're advocating you're advocating this is the way we should go, Matthew, but I'm afraid in Italy I have also, yes, I too have tasted the plate of fat. And I couldn't finish it. I just thought I'll let the Italians polish that off. I'll let my Italian friends eat it. But I suppose the core of our conversation is to do with this issue about regulation. You think we're over-regulated, Matthew?
Oh, look, I do. And I think the tragedy of what we're doing here, and certainly what I'm coming up against, is that there is all this knowledge and expertise. And I saw hundreds of producers using that knowledge and expertise at Salone. And that knowledge is not available here. So when you go to the authorities here, it's much easier for them to just say no. If they don't trust how a product is made, if Like an air-dried ham, a prosciutto, made the traditional way, is quite scary to the health authorities here because it grows mould on it. It's meat that can grow mould on the outside. That's nothing strange to the Spanish who sell their hams for $1,000 a kilo. That's actually something they aim for. It's not dangerous necessarily if it's done correctly. And I can sort of understand the regulators here being frightened of it, but all this knowledge exists, all this expertise exists, all the science exists in Europe. And we're not really tapping into it. We're not making the most of the products we already have in this country and turning them into even better products by, you know, small production processing.
Mm. Maureen, are you on the same page about this issue?
Yes, certainly. Look, one of the things that really is important about, you know, the fact that Terra Madre and Salina del Gusto actually happen, together, is that it is actually drawing those issues. It's bringing all of those issues together because the knowledge and the skills that Matthew's talking about, why don't we have access to those here? You know, we're being forced to. We love those products. Well, you might not, but, you know, I do. A lot of people love to buy those products, and we're being forced to import them rather than produce our own.
No, it's not that I don't like the. It's just the fat. It just leave aside the fat. So are there some attempts, Maureen, that you've made to get permission to produce products? Or
Perhaps not directly as yet, but certainly one of the things that Slow Food does as a movement is continue to raise those issues and certainly back them, in a political sense. If we can get those issues on the agenda, that they are certainly things that at the national level we want to be doing.
Mm. This is Bush Telegraph on ABC Radio National, and we're talking about Slow Food with Maureen Chapman, who's Secretary of Slow Food Australia, and Matthew Evans, who's a Tasmanian pork breeder and a writer about food. And they're just back from Turin, where they've been, milling with thousands of people who are enthusiasts for small food. So, Matthew, what sort of things would you like to produce that you can't?
Look, I would love to put meat in tins on a small scale. So I visited places in the south of France where they take rillette, which is a shredded pork paste. I mean, it doesn't look that exciting, but it tastes great. Mm. There are people preserving that in tins underneath their house in farmhouses in France. Now, they're not doing it in, you know, sort of a dusty cellar. They're doing it in a very hygienic room that looks like a state-of-the-art facility in terms of hygiene, but they're allowed to produce it. They have regulations to produce it. And what's great is they actually can ring up the regulatory authorities and say, I want to make these products, put them in tins. They have to be superheated to make sure they're 100% safe so they don't have to be kept in a fridge. And the authorities come and tell them, this is what how long you need to cook it for, at which temperature. They test the machine that this person's got in situ in their commercial kitchen, and then authorise them to make certain products. And I've asked about making similar things here, and because we don't have this expertise and knowledge, the burden is falling on me to prove that everything I do is safe, rather than the regulatory authorities proving once and for all, we know what's safe and we'll tell you how to produce it. It falls on small producers constantly to actually tell the authorities what is safe. When the science is known, the science is, you know, we know very clearly time, temperature, salt, moisture contents in terms of making things safe. But every small producer in Australia is required to prove that their product is safe rather than the regulatory authorities saying if you produce it to these specifications, it's guaranteed safe.
You'd have to educate the customers too, wouldn't you, Matthew? Because tinned meat doesn't have a great reputation. You know, you think of sort of camping. Well, it doesn't, does it? You think of camping.
No.
Meat
and, yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. I mean that's a marketing problem from my perspective, and something I'll come up against if I manage to get my stuff into tins. Because at the moment, I would say probably the lowest grade meat ends up in tins and not the best. But I was quite inspired to see small producers who just have a few ducks able to turn that meat into something that they can then leave on the shelf for a couple of years before it's sold, completely safely in a tin, rather than having to sell all their ducks in 1 week or all their pigs in 1 week.
Maureen, it strikes me that, we're always told that we have to value add, but here we are talking about the obstacles that stand in the way of value adding.
That's exactly right. And this is where, you know, there's a great deal of work to be done in this country around food policy. You know, we really, the food policies are being driven by the international, the conglomerates. It's not being driven by the people on the ground. You know, and I've used the term again, you know, the people. And the people are the consumers. You know, we are the ones who actually make those decisions by the choices we make every day when we purchase our food. And food is something that we all have to purchase. You know, last night in Gunnedah, I met with a group of at least 50 people who are passionate about this. They've set up their own local community garden in the TAFE College. They are running their own educational events, and they're doing all of this off their own bat. So the people, in fact, are out there, but they're the ones who need to make those decisions.
Well, we've talked about the challenge of getting the regulators on board. It's obviously a challenge to educate buyers. What about producers, Maureen? Around where you live in New England, that's in New South Wales, of course, yes. Is the slow food philosophy spreading among producers?
Yes, absolutely it is. We've just begun, during the last 12 months, we've started the local farmers markets. And when I say we, it's a community effort, not just a slow food effort. But the local people and the local producers are coming along to that in increasing numbers, as are the community members who are choosing to buy their food. They want to be able to ask questions of a producer. They want to know how and where that product, whether it's a fruit or vegetable, whether it's goat, whether it's lamb or pig, you know, where it's come from, how the animal was treated, and they can have that discussion very directly with the producer. And we're seeing those numbers increase regularly every month at those markets.
Matthew, is that your experience? Because as you've described it, there are lots of hurdles to actually making a dollar if you're a slow food producer. Oh, I think we might have lost Matthew. Well, Maureen, what are the big challenges that still face you? I'm fascinated by this idea of convivia. What are they?
Convivia. It's like a committee, except that we're nice to each other. sorry, I'm on a lot of committees. Convivia is a group of people, of like-minded people, and the term, I guess, has been coined because of the importance of food being the one thing that does actually bring people together. You know, the conviviality of the table is so important. It's where we solve our problems, it's where we air our grievances, and it's where we create and maintain our relationships. So, you know, food is so central to all of that.
So the convivia are the building blocks of the movement, are they?
That's right.
I think this is marvellous. Convivia. Convivia and gusto. These are two wonderful words that have come from the Romantic languages. Well, thank you, Maureen. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
And I don't know what happened to Matthew, but Matthew is a food writer who farms pigs in Tasmania's Huon Valley, but perhaps he went off to chase one of those pigs as it tore down the road.